things to talk about. While Dave's running around taping things, I'm just going to stall for a second. I'm going to let Dave explain because he has terse notes on his
on his outline.
Well, I was going to say. No, well, we all have a lot on our minds these days. It's been a pretty interesting summer, and it looks to be an even more interesting fall, politically speaking. But anyway, so we're going to give you a quick rundown of the things that you can expect to hear. And one of the reasons this is useful is since, again, the audio tapes that result from these broadcasts are sometimes rather difficult to find your way through because they're mostly talking and there's only two voices and things like that. But if you know up front, you can listen to the beginning of the tape and hear which article it was you wanted to find, and then you can say, well, that's probably about two-thirds of the way in, and at least you don't have to spend your time queuing through the first part of the tape. So,
In a nutshell, here we'll give you a brief rundown of what we're going to be talking about. We're going to begin by taking a look at the Sheehan Affidavit. That's from Daniel Sheehan of the Christic Institute, a public interest law firm which is suing a group of former and active-duty U.S. intelligence and military officials in connection with a bombing attack on Tony Avergan. Tony Avergan is a journalist who's worked variously for ABC, public radio, and other institutions. He and his wife, Martha Honey, filed suit following the Lapenka bombing, which we talked about in our last program. The Christic Institute is handling that lawsuit for them. They filed suit, I can't remember off the top of my head whether it's 28 or 29 different individuals whom they have termed the secret team. We're going to begin by taking a look at the machinations of the secret team in Iran, specifically a covert assassination program undertaken against political opponents and enemies of the former Shah. And after that, we're going to take a look at connections between that operation and Edwin Wilson's and Frank Turpel's operations in Libya, which, according to the Sheehan Affidavit, were also directly connected with, among other things, the assassination of terrorists working against the Shah of Iran from Libya. We're going to take a look at the banking connections of the drug money, and I should say that in this broadcast as well, narcotics will be flowing in and out of the picture, although to a somewhat smaller extent than before. As was the case with our previous broadcasts, the terror and drug connections intersect very closely. There will be a lot of overlap between the various denominations in the material that we've made. We're breaking it down in this way so as to make it sort of conceptualizable, or I don't know what the word would be, but to make it understandable in terms of a conceptual framework for the listeners. There will be a lot of overlap. You'll hear articles in the cover-up, which you've already heard. We will be coming back to drug smuggling in a big way in the third of our terror programs. That, by the way, is scheduled for September 13th from 7 to 11 p.m. We're going to take a look at, as I said, the secret team's machinations in Iran. After taking a look at Turpel and Wilson's operations in Libya, we're going to take a look at an interesting connection. We're going to be developing a player in the Iran-Contra scandal whose name has not emerged in the course of the public hearings. We're going to be taking a look at the influence of Henry Kissinger upon many of the people and institutions involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. Specifically, Henry Kissinger was directing Task Force 157, one of the manifestations of which was the Nugenhand Bank. That was the former Green Beret Bank, the bank in Australia, which was essentially a joint U.S. Naval Intelligence and CIA operation. We're going to take a look at Henry Kissinger's role directing that. We're going to take a look at the secret team's early arms dealings in Iran. We're going to take a look at an interesting situation in which Jimmy Carter may have helped to unload his own situation. Jimmy Carter brought to an end the official U.S. intelligence operation in Iran, the Turpel Wilson team and their directors Shackley and Clines. We're going to take a look at Carter's terminating of that, and Jimmy Carter's terminating of a previous tradition of subsidizing the mullahs in Iran to the tune of $400 million a year. That may have very well helped end Jimmy Carter's presidency. We're going to take a look at Henry Kissinger's role in getting the hostages, or getting the Shah, rather, admitted to the United States for medical treatment. That resulted directly in the taking of the U.S. hostages in Iran. That was forecast, the taking of the hostages by the U.S. National Security Establishment. Ultimately, the hostage crisis, probably more than anything else, got rid of Jimmy Carter as President of the United States. What we're going to be looking at in this program, in a general sense, is the deliberate use of terror to overthrow the American system of government. We're going to be taking a look at the distinct possibility that the Reagan team and the secret team employed a number, or manipulated, really, terrorism in such a way as to deliberately eliminate Jimmy Carter's presidency. In a sense, it appears that Jimmy Carter made the same mistake that John Kennedy did. He attempted to buck the national security establishment and the intelligence services in particular. He lost the presidency as a result. At least he's ahead of John Kennedy. John Kennedy, of course, lost his life. We're going to take a look at a lot of information from the now-defunct Rebel magazine, a political publication put out by Larry Flint. And specifically, we're going to take a look at a long article by Don Fried indicating that, in fact, the secret team, the Iran-Contra players, deliberately deep-sixed the Desert One rescue mission, the so-called debacle in the desert, the attempt to rescue the hostages in April of 1980. After that, we're going to take a look at a couple of indications, a couple of other uses of terrorism, and we're going to take a look at another interesting situation connected with the hostage crisis, the as-yet incompletely defined role of a man named Cyrus Hashemi. He was involved with attempting to negotiate the hostage release in light of his connections to a number of different people who are players in the Iran-Contra scandal. One wonders whether he was actually part of the back-channel intelligence operation we're going to be talking about to see to it that the hostages did not, in fact, get released. After that, we're going to take a look at a couple of long articles, a short article from The Nation and a long article from In These Times, dealing with the so-called October Surprise Group put together by the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration was afraid that the Carter administration would be able to work out a successful deal to get the hostages released before the 1980 elections. There are a lot of indications that, in fact, the Reagan administration committed treason and effected the removal of Jimmy Carter by working out a deal with the Iranians to sell them arms once Ronald Reagan came to office. This, in effect, was the, as we're looking at during the course of the program, the deliberate manipulation of terrorism in such a way as to change the American system of government. And again, the point should be made, we'll make it later in the broadcast, we're not saying that, for example, the people who took the hostages, the embassy personnel hostage in 1979, were paid agents of the United States government. What we're pointing out is how these situations were manipulated by people in positions of control in order to produce the desired outcome. In other words, we're really looking. I could just about go to sleep right now. I'm so tired. We're really looking at the deliberate manipulation of terrorism in a strategic fashion. After the examination of the so-called October Surprise Group and their apparent deal with the Iranians to block the release of the hostages and effect the removal of Jimmy Carter as president, we're going to take a look at some really unnerving indications that this same October Surprise Group metamorphosed into what essentially was a fascist group within the United States government that was seeking to, well, basically suspend constitutional authority in the United States. They had bucked constitutional authority with great regularity in the past. It appears that there was a very, very sound, in terms of solid and substantial scheme afoot to get the U.S. Constitution suspended and establish martial law in the United States. We're going to take a look at that. We're going to take a look at a plan called Rex 84, a contingency plan by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, in which martial law would have been established in the United States. Among the features of that martial law plan would have been the setting up of a military government for every section of the United States, the internment of approximately 500,000 Central American refugees in detention camps, the deputizing of a number of ultra-right-wingers, Nazi, Klan, and Posse Comitatus types, as official agents of the United States government, and even a contingency plan to intern all 21 million blacks in the United States, there were 21 million at the time the plan was developed some time ago, in detention camps or concentration camps. After that, we're going to wind up with a look at something called the King Alfred Plan, a hotly debated document which some researchers maintained was fiction. It was first published in a work of fiction, however, the author disclosed to a number of people that, in fact, the document is real. Mae Brussel obtained a copy of the document. She sent it to us. That document, called the King Alfred Plan, was entered into a documentary show, which is available from Archives on Audio, called The King Alfred Plan. It is a contingency plan for the rounding up and eventual extermination of all blacks in the United States. Many researchers, we've taken a lot of heat, so has May, for standing behind the King Alfred Plan. A lot of researchers maintained that it was a fraud. It now appears as if we've already had indications from things like Jonestown, the Atlanta child murders and a number of other things, that there are large elements of the national security establishment in this country which think along those lines. It is now a matter of public record that indeed the National Security Council has developed such a contingency plan, and we're going to talk about that. And that will be winding up the discussion for this evening. So again, what we're going to be looking at throughout the broadcast is the deliberate strategic manipulation of terrorism in order to subvert the American system of government. And again, the point should be made that we're not saying that some of the fanatics, and the religious fanatics in Iran and some of the other terrorists were paid agents of the government. I've no doubt that some of them were, but the point is that it's possible to manipulate people in such a way as to produce a desired result. One wonders whether the hostages, the people who took the hostages in Iran, in Tehran in 1979, realized that they were boosting the American far right. That, and it appears that that's what they did, and that the American far right was able to manipulate that situation in just such a direction. In a nutshell, that's what we have on tap. The details are following right now.
Indeed, and let's open up the nutshell and examine the interior a little more carefully. We're going to start with something from the Sheehan affidavit as prepared for the Christic Institute suit that Dave already described on behalf of Tony Avrigan and Martha Honey. And Sheehan, in his affidavit, is talking about the period towards the end of the Vietnam War when Theodore Shackley, Thomas Kleins, Richard Armitage, some other people were involved in several things in Vietnam, including the Phoenix Program, an extremely simple sort of a pacification program that was implemented in the Vietnamese countryside, that being anybody remotely suspicious was killed, basically. At the same time, of course, as we've talked about at great length in other broadcasts, they were relying heavily on the aid of local drug lords, one of them being the most noted being a Laotian by the name of Vang Pao, and that a lot of money was being generated through the opium trade, through the CIA's protection of the opium trade and the secret team's involvement with it, and their use of American government and military planes and soldiers and things of that nature.
It should be remembered now that the second of our broadcasts in the Iran-Contra series, the first of our programs about terrorism, focused almost exclusively on the Turple Wilson team. We've looked at them extensively over the course of our archive shows as basically being people who were the homme de main, so to speak, the people who were there to actually see to it that the terrorists were manipulated in such a strategic fashion as to be beneficial to the national security establishment. We talked about the Turple Wilson team almost exclusively in RFA number 30. We're going to be picking up with the Turple Wilson team and some of their machinations right now. And it should be remembered, perhaps particularly for later in the broadcast, that we took a look at members of the Turple Wilson team not only setting up the Lapenka bombing, initially blamed on the Sandinistas by our national security establishment, but perhaps even more importantly, the proposed bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Costa Rica, the resulting assassination of U.S. Ambassador to Costa Rica, Louis Tams. That was going to be blamed on the Sandinistas, used as an excuse to invade Nicaragua, and the martial law plan that we're going to end up with this evening was going to be perhaps put in effect if there were any widespread domestic protests. It makes sense that there would be. So again, the Triple Wilson team was what we dealt with last time. That's exactly where we're going to be picking up again.
Reading from the Sheehan affidavit. Immediately upon the conclusion of the evacuation of U.S. personnel from Vietnam, Richard Armitage was dispatched by Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins from Vietnam to Tehran, Iran. In Iran, Armitage, the quote, bursar for the Vang Pao opium money for Shackley and Kleins' planned secret team covert operations program, between May and August of 1975, set up a secret, quote, financial conduit inside Iran, into which the secret Vang Pao drug funds could be deposited from Southeast Asia. The purpose of this conduit was to serve as the vehicle for secret funding by Shackley's secret team of a private, non-CIA, authorized black operations inside Iran, disposed to seek out, identify, and assassinate socialist and communist sympathizers who were viewed by Shackley and his secret team members to be, quote, potential terrorists against the Shah of Iran's government in Iran. In late 1975 and early 1976, Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins retained Edwin Wilson to travel to Tehran, Iran, to head up the, quote, secret team covert anti-terrorist assassination program in Iran. This was not a U.S. government-authorized operation. This was a private operation supervised, directed, and participated in by Shackley, Klein, Secord, and Armitage in their purely private capacities. I would just say parenthetically that is Mr. Sheehan's assertion. I'm not sure that I completely agree with him that this was a private operation.
Yeah, hearkening back to a very important quote that we relied on in Radio Free America number 4 about the Turbo Wilson team, former Air Force focal point officer L. Fletcher Prouty, an Air Force colonel who worked very closely with the CIA, said in so many words that if you're a mercenary abroad, you're acting there with the go-ahead of the United States government, and as he put it, either you wouldn't get there in the first place or they would see to it that something happened to you over there. He simply said there are no high-level freelance mercenaries anymore. If you're over there, you're in an official capacity, even if it isn't an overt official capacity. And indeed, later on in the affidavit, the Sheehan, the Christic people talk about how initially this was an operation set up with the imprimatur of the highest levels of the U.S. government. The scenario that we're going to be introducing is similar to the scenario we introduced in the Guns of November with regard to President Kennedy, where he defied the wishes of the national security establishment, they being more powerful than he, continued to operate against his wishes, and eventually were able to remove the chief executive, which proved an irritation. In Dallas, Texas, by bullets, in Washington, D.C., or perhaps Plains, Georgia, through the manipulation of hostages and terror, and that's what we're going to be looking at.
All right, so continuing with the Sheehan affidavit, in late 75 and early 76, they're saying Shackley and Klein's called Edwin Wilson to Tehran to head up the secret team's anti-terrorist assassination program. Continuing, at the end of 1975, Richard Armitage took the post of a, quote, special consultant to the U.S. Department of Defense regarding American military personnel missing in action, MIAs, in Southeast Asia. In this capacity, Armitage was posted in the U.S. Embassy in Bangkok, Thailand. There, Armitage had top responsibility for locating and retrieving American MIAs in Southeast Asia. He worked at the embassy with an associate, one Jerry O. Daniels. From 1975 to 1977, Armitage held this post in Thailand. However, he did not perform the duties of this office. Instead, Armitage continued to function as the bursar for Theodore Shackley's secret team, seeing to it that secret Vang Pao opium funds were conducted from Laos through Armitage in Thailand to both Tehran and the secret Shackley bank account in Australia at the Nugan Hand Bank. The monies conducted by Armitage to Tehran were to fund Edwin Wilson's secret anti-terrorist Seek and Destroy operation on behalf of Theodore Shackley. Again, long time, even relatively short time, One Step Beyond listeners, of course, are familiar with the Nugan Hand Bank, a fascinating intelligence bank run by ex-military and intelligence officials involved in all kinds of things, as we'll hear about, including the attempted overthrow of a friendly government and all kinds of interesting things of that sort.
Yeah, we dealt with the Nugan Hand Bank in considerable length, and it was one of the first items we dealt with at the beginning of Radio Free America number 25, again available from archives on audio. And we also came back to the Nugan Hand Bank in connection with the secret team and their drug dealings in Radio Free America number 29, the first of our programs on the Iran-Contra scandal. Of this secret assassination team in the assassination project in Libya, directed again by Edwin Wilson and Frank Turple, the Sheehan people, or Daniel Sheehan and the Christic Institute people, write as follows. In a section called The Wilson Connection in Iran, they write, "In February of 1986, I went to the house of source number 47 and was introduced to source number 48. He was a former U.S. intelligence officer who served in Iran from 1976 through 1980. In our interviews, source number 48 set forth the details of a highly secret assassination project which operated in Iran from 1976 to 1980 under the supervision of defendant Theodore Shackley and defendant Thomas Kleins. This project was supervised in the Middle East by one Edwin Wilson. Source number 48, who worked as an anti-terrorist specialist in the U.S. military mission in Iran, was in a special position to have personal knowledge about the project run by Edwin Wilson, since Wilson's program operated under the rubric of an anti-terrorist project." An anti-terrorist, quite appropriately, is in quotes here. Source number 48 set forth in detail how this covert, quote, anti-terrorist, unquote, search and destroy operation was set up in 1976 under the overall supervision of the Assistant Deputy Director of Operations for the American Central Intelligence Agency, Theodore Shackley, and his deputy, Thomas Kleins. However, source number 48 was convinced that this operation became a criminal, privately run, non-CIA-authorized program as of 1977, after President Jimmy Carter and CIA Director Stansfield Turner entered the government. And again, I would interrupt once again that we're going to be talking about whether this was really, well, criminal certainly, but privately run. I think the a more appropriate way of phrasing it was that this was a criminal government operation, because it appears that what happened was when the secret team was disconnected from its official capacity, basically they defied the will of the chief executive, and this would certainly not be the first time for Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins. We took a look at their operations in the JM Wave Station out of Cuba, out of Florida, rather, to be used against Cuba, and, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, which was so central to the assassination of John Kennedy, who also began aborting covert operations opposing U.S. national security policy and paid the price, although not he paid a dearer price than Jimmy Carter. But again, officially, this was a U.S. government operation, supposedly terminated from its official status in 1977. Continuing with Daniel Sheehan's affidavit. This privately run anti-terrorist assassination program was authorized and controlled by Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins in their purely private non-governmental capacity from 1977 to 79. During this 1977 to 79 period, Edwin Wilson, in his private capacity as the field director of this private Shackley-Kleins project, established contact in Libya with Muammar Gaddafi and secretly agreed to train Libyan anti-Shah of Iran terrorists in the use of deadly C4 explosives at five secret terrorist training camps located inside Libya. While entirely criminal in nature, Edwin Wilson's activities with these Libyan terrorists were actually intelligence-gathering activities, designed to put into his hands the identities, missions, and targets of the Libyan anti-Shah terrorist operations. Once this intelligence information was obtained by Wilson, in his capacity as a trainer and supplier for the terrorists, Wilson would secretly communicate the identities and mission of particular terrorists to Rafael Chichi Quintero, who was responsible for interdicting, unquote, and directing the assassination of these Libyan terrorists. And again, I would hearken back to the Sheehan phrase in the paragraph before where he says, while entirely criminal in nature, Edwin Wilson's activities with these Libyan terrorists were actually intelligence-gathering activities designed to put into his hands the identities, missions, and targets of the Libyan anti-Shah terrorist operations. Well, there are a couple of things to stress in this particular section of the Sheehan affidavit. The first, again, is that this operation was an official operation set forth by the CIA and other elements of the U.S. national security establishment. As we're going to look at, Jimmy Carter terminated this in 1977, and Stansfield Turner, as we've looked at in our previous Edwin Wilson, Frank Turple shows, terminated the Turple-Wilson team. The scenario that we're going to be presenting here is that, in effect, the intelligence services in the military defied the presidential authority. Just as John Kennedy attempted to reverse our directions in Cuba and Vietnam, our Cold War policy towards the Soviet Union, and was unable to do so because the national security establishment defied him, as they had President Eisenhower before him, we're going to be taking a look at what we feel is a similar scenario. And again, Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins go back to Station JM Wave. It should also be noted that our thesis concerning the Wilson activities in Libya, while we don't dispute at all the Sheehan material here concerning the Shah, the anti-Shah terrorist operations, was to manipulate this terrorism in such a way. One of the things we're going to be focusing on primarily in the next broadcast is the massive connections between the far right in this country and the members of the secret team and many of the mainstream terrorist organizations which have been plaguing this country and the rest of the world in the 1980s. It is against these terrorist organizations that we're told we must arm. And again, the scenario we come back to so often, and I think it's a scenario which is going to be echoed rather closely tonight, is the Reichstag scenario. Setting up a provocation, a terrorist incident, using that as an excuse to suspend civil liberties at home, or in this case, the very Constitution itself, and we are going to be looking at it as an excuse to justify military intervention abroad. So our contention is that where it was considered important or necessary to assassinate the terrorists, the Libyan terrorists, they were indeed assassinated. It is our contention that some of them were used in strategic scenarios. And again, we're allowed to complete their missions when it would prove strategically useful, just as the students, the Iranian militants in 1979, were permitted to complete their mission at the U.S. Embassy because it suited the purpose of certain interests. Among those interests, Henry Kissinger.
Indeed, and we're going to get back to sort of an intersection here between Henry Kissinger and the Nugenhand folks and the secret team.
And remember that it was the Nugenhand Bank, which was the bank into which the working capital derived from drug money for this operation, which we've just described, went. So Nugenhand is inextricably linked with the Wilson operations in the Middle East.
I'm going to read now from Penny Lernew's book, In Banks We Trust. For those of you who don't know, Penny Lernew's last name is spelled L-E-R-N-O-U-X. The book was published in 1984 by Anchor Press Doubleday in hardback. Penny Lernew's In Banks We Trust, she's talking about Nugenhand Bank. In addition to drugs, Nugenhand was involved in various arms deals with Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, Brazil, and the White Rhodesian government of Ian Smith. The bank also did business with Edwin Wilson, the former CIA agent convicted in the United States of selling explosives to Libya, and charged with supplying trained men arms and technology to Libya and other military buyers. Memos and testimony by Nugenhand employees show that Hand met with Wilson in Bangkok and that Houghton held discussions with him in Switzerland. Intelligence sources also claimed that Houghton used Nugenhand's Saudi Arabian branch to finance Wilson's arms smuggling operation. In view of such activities, one might ask why so many high-ranking U.S. military men lent their names and prestige to the bank. Part of the answer may lie in the U.S. intelligence community's obvious ties to Nugenhand. While Colby and Admiral Yates denied any connection between the CIA and the bank, General Black was not so sure. Quote, "I'm not saying it's not possible," he allowed, "but I certainly wasn't aware of it." Walter McDonald, a Nugenhand consultant and former CIA deputy director, was also uncertain. Quote, "I really don't see it happening, but I can't vouch for it," unquote. Technically, they may have been correct, since the bank apparently was originally part of a deep-cover intelligence operation known as Task Force 157, which worked with the CIA but was controlled by the U.S. Office of Naval Intelligence and was directly responsible to strong-willed Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. The task force gained notoriety when 21 of its former agents took the Navy to court to demand civil service benefits after the group was abruptly disbanded in 1977 because of some unknown internal scandal. Mark that, too. That's kind of interesting. Ed Wilson had a desk and his own staff at the task force's Washington headquarters and is credited with supplying the operation's front name, Pierce Morgan. Informed sources said that Task Force 157 used the Nugenhand Bank for covert naval intelligence money, just as the CIA used it to undermine Australia's Labor government. Now, the interesting things here, of course, Henry Kissinger heading up Task Force 157. Task Force 157, of course, being the fount of much of the things we're going to talk about tonight, Nugenhand being only one of them, the secret team as a whole being largely sprung from Task Force 157. It's also interesting that the task force disbanded in 1977 for a variety of reasons. We're going to talk about in just a moment about some other things that happened in 1977 having to do with the intelligence establishment and its relationship with the executive branch.
Basically, yeah. Again, one thing that we've talked about in connection with Turple Wilson was how Theodore Shackley, Thomas Kleins, Edwin Wilson et al. Were formally fired by Stansfield Turner, Jimmy Carter's CIA director. And again, it appears that neither Jimmy Carter nor Stansfield Turner really had control of the reins of the National Security Establishment, as their attempt to unhorse the dark knights of this same National Security Establishment resulted in their own unhorsing instead. Jimmy Carter did not last long as president. The secret team, as the Iran-Contra scandal has made very, very clear, is very much on the scene. Returning once again to the Sheehan affidavit, and again, Henry Kissinger is a person whose influence we're going to be looking at in the Iran-Contra scandal. The Kissinger footprints are everywhere, although his name has not been directly mentioned. It should be perhaps remembered as we deal with Henry Kissinger that it was Henry Kissinger who was named by President Reagan to head up a commission to review and determine the course of America's Central American policy in 1983. So the Kissinger heading up of the Central American Commission is something to be borne in mind as we reflect on the Kissinger footprints around this complex we're looking at. Again, returning to the Sheehan affidavit. From 1977 until 79, Richard Armitage remained in Bangkok, opening and operating a business named the Far East Trading Company. This company had offices only in Bangkok and in Washington, D.C. This company was, in fact, from 1977 to 79, merely a front for Armitage's secret operations conducting Vang Pao opium money out of Southeast Asia to Tehran and the Nguyen Bank in Australia to fund the ultra-right, private, anti-communist, anti-terrorist assassination program and unconventional warfare operation of Theodore Shackley's and Thomas Klein's secret team. During this period between 1975 and 79 in Bangkok, Richard Armitage lived in the home of Heini Aderholt, the former air wing commander of Shackley's Special Operations Group in Laos, who, between 1966 and 8, had served as the immediate superior to Richard Secord, the deputy air wing commander of MAGSOG. Secord, in 1975, was transferred from Vietnam to Tehran, Iran. And in a section called Early Iran Arms Deal Profit Skimming, Daniel Sheehan states, in 1976, Richard Secord moved to Tehran, Iran, and became the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in Iran, in charge of the Middle Eastern Division of the Defense Security Assistance Administration. In this capacity, Secord functioned as the Chief Operations Officer for the U.S. Defense Department in the Middle East, in charge of foreign military sales of U.S. aircraft, weapons, and military equipment to Middle Eastern nations allied to the U.S. Secord's immediate superior was Eric von Marbod, the former 40 Committee liaison officer to Theodore Shackley's Phoenix program in Vietnam from 1973 to 75. From 1976 to 79 in Iran, Richard Secord supervised the sale of U.S. military aircraft and weapons to Middle Eastern nations. However, Richard Secord did not authorize direct nation-to-nation sales of such equipment directly from the U.S. government to said Middle Eastern governments. Instead, Richard Secord conducted such sales through a middleman, one Albert Hakim. By the use of middleman Albert Hakim, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Richard Secord purchased U.S. military aircraft and weapons from the U.S. government at the low manufacturer's cost, but sold these U.S. aircraft and weapons to the client Middle Eastern nations at the much higher replacement cost. Secord then caused to be paid to the U.S. government, out of the actual sale price obtained, only the lower amount equal to the lower manufacturer's cost. The difference was secreted from the U.S. government, and Secord and Albert Hakim secretly transferred these millions of dollars into Shackley's secret team operations inside Iran and into Shackley's secret Nguyen bank account in Australia. Thus, by 1976, Defendant Albert Hakim had become a partner with Thomas Klein's, Richard Secord, and Richard Armitage in Theodore Shackley's secret team. So it should be remembered that in 1977, Jimmy Carter and his CIA director Stansfield Turner, quote, fire, unquote, Theodore Shackley, Thomas Klein's, and Edwin Wilson. Their operations continue apace in Iran, and at this same time, Albert Hakim and Richard Secord are functioning in an official, a still-sanctioned, U.S. capacity to sell weapons in that part of the world. So while officially the Shackley-Klein's-Wilson connection has been disconnected, and again it appears that the momentum there was too strong to disconnect, that in fact they disconnected the Carter administration, as we're about to look at, it should be remembered that Richard Secord is in Iran working with this secret team, and the funds are being deposited into the Nguyen Bank, part of Task Force 157, involving Edwin Wilson and run by Henry Kissinger. And it should be remembered that, as Nip is about to indicate to you, the Carter administration ran afoul in a big way of supporters of the Shah of Iran, and those included many powerful people, including the Rockefellers, by essentially cutting off a long-standing CIA tradition.
The next article we're going to read was provided to us by Mabe Russell. The article is from the San Francisco Chronicle for Monday, March 3rd of 1980. That's 8-0. The article is headlined, CIA Subsidized Iran's Ayatollahs, Story Says. Dateline Washington. This is a UPI story. President Carter abruptly halted CIA payments supporting Iran's Islamic religious affairs in 1977, despite warnings that the cutoff would undermine the Shah, according to Politics Today magazine. In the magazine's recent issue, writer Daniel Drews said details of the events were provided by, quote, six agents, former agents, and intelligence analysts with connections in Tehran, the U.S. State Department, and the White House. Drews said the CIA payments began in 1953, following the Shah's ouster by Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. The CIA assisted in restoring the Shah to the throne and began payments to the country's ayatollahs and mullahs, in essence buying support for the Shah, he said. Quote, for the next decade, the Shah and Iran's religious leaders coexisted more or less peacefully, while the CIA quietly sent regular payments to help support the mullahs, Druze said. Druze added, quote, at least one informed source contends that the amount paid had reached as much as $400 million a year, while other sources said that figure is too high. But the payments came to an abrupt halt shortly after Carter became president in 1977, when the Washington Post revealed payments of $10 million a year to Jordan's King Hussein, Druze said. Quote, Carter was furious. The new president, who had waged his campaign on the need for honesty in government, ordered that all such payoffs to Jordan and any other foreign governments be stopped immediately. Druze said the CIA quietly informed Carter about the Iranian payments, explaining that without the payments, quote, the mullahs might actively oppose the Shah. No matter. Carter closed the bank. Nearly 2.5 decades of CIA payments abruptly came to an end. Druze said the payments cutoff was followed by religious upheaval that spread in the months thereafter and ended in February 1978 when the Iranian monarch was forced out. Well, a couple of interesting things to think about here. First of all is of course, Jimmy Carter, by trying to bring the secret team to heel and bring government above board, was in fact slitting his own political throat. At the same time, it's rather interesting to conjecture about a few things. Now, the sort of underlying suggestion of the article is that maybe the cutoff of money caused the religious supporters or the religious men, the ayatollahs and mullahs and their supporters to start getting rowdy and riotous. In fact, what perhaps maybe happened, and this is just an idea to float through, but maybe when Carter cut off the official money, the mullahs and the ayatollahs began getting their money from another less official but nonetheless just as equally American source, and that in fact they were not rioting because they were depressed or angry that they weren't being paid off by the CIA anymore, but perhaps because their new paymasters were telling them to, or at least inciting them to in some way.
That's a possible scenario that should be borne in mind. We can't say for sure. Obviously, what we do know is that Jimmy Carter cut off the decade and a half, or let's see, 1953 through 77, 2.5 decade tradition of payments to the mullahs. This, for whatever reason, brought about the downfall of the Shah. In other words, how deep the conspiratorial waters here are, we can't say, but as a direct result of that cutoff, the Shah was overthrown. It should be borne in mind here, as was obviously heavily implied in what Nip said, that for a long time, in addition to supporting the Shah, we were also controlling his opposition, so that really we ran both sides in Iran. We ran the Shah, and we ran the mullahs. The question is, and we know now, from the revelations in the Iran-Contra scandal, that the secret team has been dealing with the mullahs all along. That is to say, with the theocratic government of Iran based on the mullahs, the religious leaders in Iran. The question is, again, are those contacts extant? And just what exactly the goal of the cutting off of payments may have been on the part of certain people.
Even though we haven't discussed it very much during the course of these broadcasts, we've talked about the fact that there is still an open, thriving channel of guns and drug money passing back and forth between the United States and Afghanistan. And, of course, in Afghanistan, the main backers of the Mujahideen, outside of the U.S. itself, of course, are, in fact, the self-same mullahs, although Afghanistani, many of them, but the self-same religious fundamentalist mullahs that we now turn out to have been dealing with in Iran all along. And they are also very much in control. As a matter of fact, this is one of the reasons for the revolt in Afghanistan, was the disenfranchisement of the mullahs and their traditional power by the Kabul government.
One of the things we're going to be taking a look at now, and again, the Shah, who had many powerful friends in the United States, including the Rockefellers, with whom he banked his $20 billion or so worth of oil profits, were very, very upset when the Shah was overthrown. Jimmy Carter, at least up to a certain extent, was responsible for this overthrow by cutting off the CIA payments to the mullahs. What we're going to be examining is whether or not this policy, you know, the wisdom of it, we're not going to debate the relative wisdom of it or merits of that policy here. The fact of the matter appears to be that people who were upset with Jimmy Carter's failure to support the Shah, including the payments to the mullahs, effected the removal of Jimmy Carter as President of the United States. And again, it should be, we should perhaps hearken back to the assassination of President Kennedy, where we have Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins working back with what the Christic Institute called the Traficante Shooters Team, and again, they were working out of Station JM Wave in Florida against Fidel Castro. This is the whole Bay of Pigs thing. And in Radio Free America number 12, we examined what we called the Cuban Fry Corps, literally an underground extension of the U.S. military, which continued to operate in the fashion it desired, in direct contravention of presidential wishes and orders. And when those orders became somewhat more forceful, they undertook the successful assassination of the President of the United States. The Shackley-Kleins team running Station JM Wave is the same team we're looking at here. And what we're going to be examining for much of this broadcast is the possibility that, in effect, Jimmy Carter experienced a less bloody repetition of John Kennedy's fate. They say when history... Was it Marx who said, when history repeats itself, it does so first as tragedy and then as farce. Perhaps Robert Kennedy was the tragedy, if one can rely on that particular bit of wisdom. Perhaps Jimmy Carter was the farce, because it does appear that the Carter presidency was removed as a direct result of the manipulation of the hostage crisis. Now, recall that the Shah, after having been deposed, came down with cancer. He was admitted to the United States for treatment. This provoked the taking of the hostages. That eliminated Jimmy Carter as President of the United States. And we're going to take a look at the manipulation of the hostage crisis in just a minute. It should be noted that there were abundant warnings that the Shah should not be admitted to the United States, lest it result in Iranian reprisals against the U.S. Embassy personnel. And we're going to take a look at Henry Kissinger and his role with David Rockefeller in pressuring Carter to admit the Shah. Research credit on the following article goes to Mae Brussell, again, a magnificent researcher out of Carmel whose programs air on the station and with whom we've been working for a long time. This particular article is a Jack Anderson column. It was run in the Monterey Herald on December 10th of 1979, and the Herald headlined the Anderson column, "Early Warnings About the Shah," in Stateline, Washington. In the back rooms of Washington, everyone seemed to know that the Shah was bad news. The State Department and Central Intelligence Agency advised against admitting him to the United States. It would probably incite militants in Iran, they warned, to storm the American embassy and seize American hostages. President Carter was aware of the warnings. In response to implorings that he admit the Shah, Carter reportedly once asked his advisors ruefully, "When the Iranians take our people in Tehran hostage, what will you advise me then?" Unquote. Nevertheless, he personally authorized the Shah's entry. Secretary of State Cyrus Vance understood the danger. July 26th, he sent an urgent eyes-only cable to Chargé d'Affaires L. Bruce Langen in Tehran, Langen, L-A-I-N-G-E-N. "We are considering," the cable posed, "how to respond to the Shah's continuing query to us through various channels regarding establishing residence in the United States. I would like to have your personal and private evaluation of the effect of such a move on the safety of Americans in Iran, especially the official Americans in the compound." Langen worked that the Shah's arrival in America could ignite anti-American actions, including probable reprisals against the embassy. Yet Vance advised the president to admit the Shah on humanitarian grounds, unquote. Skipping down in the column, "The compelling question is why? Why were our leaders so determined to admit the Shah contrary to the best interests of the United States? The usual justification is that they could not turn their back on a loyal ally and that they could not give the Ayatollah a veto power over who can enter the country." Poppycock, "Their greater obligation was not to the Shah but to the national interests. A day seldom passes that the United States doesn't bar undesirables whose presence would not be helpful. The pressure to admit the Shah came primarily from David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger. Despite their disclaimers, they conducted a relentless campaign in Washington to grant the Shah refuge. The respected foreign affairs specialist George Ball was correct in calling it obnoxious pressure," unquote. The Rockefeller-Kissinger alibi that they made only limited personal contacts is pure deception. They directed the campaign, they pulled the strings, they enlisted others to join in the pressure. In previous columns, we have examined their motivation. They have multi-million-dollar financial ties to the Shah. I would add that actually the proper phrase there should have been multi-billion dollars. Again, the Shah of Iran was banking the profits from the Iranian oil trade with the Chase Manhattan Bank, a key Rockefeller property. When the mullahs, when the Islamic regime, the Ayatollah, took over, they began withdrawing the profits from the bank. The hostage crisis permitted Chase Manhattan to freeze the Iranian assets at that time, thereby halting a potentially fatal drain on the Chase Manhattan capital. It should also be noted here that Henry Kissinger, obviously the Rockefeller-Kissinger interests, would not have been pleased by the loss of the Shah's profits. In addition, Henry Kissinger, obviously, as we've seen, was directly tied to the secret team through Task Force 157. With the abundant warnings of what would probably happen if the Shah was admitted, another motivating factor that we have to examine is the possibility that, in effect, Henry Kissinger sought to have just such a result ensue, that basically the sight of Jimmy Carter bound hand and foot with the hostage crisis was not unappealing to people who resented his policies in the Middle East. And we're talking about the secret team and quite possibly Kissinger also.
Okay, I think at this point we're going to take a break, and then we're going to get back and get a little more deeply into the deep sixing of the Iranian hostage crisis and the Carter presidency, in fact.
Just one quick item I'll throw out as we zero in on some of the Rockefeller connections to this, and we'll touch back on Rockefeller connections in the future. We don't want to give people indications that we are of the persuasion of a lot of highly visible right-wing conspiracy theorists, unquote, who talk all about the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Rockefellers, the One World Conspiracy, and they usually get into the protocols of the Elders of Zion and the International Jewish Conspiracy, etc. Obviously the Rockefellers are arguably the single most powerful financial and industrial element, certainly in this country, possibly in the world. And the Chase Manhattan Bank, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Trilateral Commission are absolutely critical to study, and they are very important and very conspiratorial. We just want to sort of demark our turf here so as not to be confused, particularly by perhaps people who are listening for the first time, with a group of John Birch Society theorists who do focus on some of these same elements, although for radically different motivations and coming up with radically different conclusions.
But you're going to have to wait to find out how exactly we mark off that turf until we get back from a break. So don't go away. We have, of course, a good 3 hours more of Radio Free America tonight and lots of interesting stuff, and we're going to try and put some of these things that we've been alluding to over the last few months about the Iranian hostage crisis, the October surprise, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to try and put it in some kind of cohesive form. I'm not going to try. We're going to. And that's what's going to be coming up. So don't go away. Dave and myself will return in just a few minutes with more of Radio Free America right here on KFJC.